Hello and welcome to the X-Cast, X-Files Podwatch. This is episode 59, where we'll be discussing episodes Folie à Deux and The End. I'm your host, Clara Cook, and with me is Darren Mooney. Hello, Darren.
Hello, Clara. Pleased to talk to you again.
Yes. So the last time we talked, we did Never Again and Memento Mori. So are you looking forward to these episodes?
I am indeed. I suspect it'll be quite a similar mix this time around. One sort of vaguely Monster of the Week episode written by a well-regarded writer, and one sort of standalone mythology episode, which maybe we might have some strong opinions about.
Definitely. So first of all, let's talk about Folie à Deux. So Folie à Deux is episode 19 of season 5. It was written by Vince Gilligan and directed by Kim Manners. A brief outline of what the story is Scully and Mulder meet a delusional man who has convinced his boss is a monster and is willing to prove to the world that his boss is a monster in a very violent way. The title Folie à Deux is mentioned several times in the episode, which is French for it's a saying, which basically means a madness shared by two. So a madness that's almost kind of catching between two people. So, Darren, what did you think of this episode?
I love Folie à Deux. I really, really adore it. And I think it's like Unusual Suspects in that it's a fifth season episode written by Vince Gilligan that is massively underrated because it is not bad blood. One of the things that I really, really like about Folie à Deux is, well, obviously it's a great Mulder and Scully episode in that the madness shared by two, they talk about the title, refers to the madness that's shared by Mulder and Scully. But it's one of three episodes that Gilligan wrote at the end of the fifth season going into the sixth season that deals with this idea of sort of capitalism and this sort of question of like workers and staff and drones and money and how money sort of dehumanizes people. So it's a theme that comes up again in Drive, where, you know, basically, it ends with Mulder taking off his tie and being billed for the destruction of human life. And it continues then until Monday, which is about the robbing of a bank and like a janitor who dreams of having a better life. But Folie à Deux is a great story about a worker who's working at this anonymous, like, cubicle farm cold calling center who starts to suspect that his boss is this creepy insect-like creature that is basically sucking the humanity out of his co-workers and turning them into either drones or zombies, which is kind of that wonderful sort of loaded term that people use for people who work 9 to 5 in like soul destroying jobs. It really captures the sense of working in like an office farm where like personality is sort of stripped away and where people are sort of reduced to numbers and where you're reading call sheets all day. Like, there's the great moment at the start where he's ringing up on behalf of Vinyl Right and he's talking about, you know, I like to put a crisp $100 bill in your hand, and you see the pause for response and then continue. And sometimes the pause for response is, look, dude, I don't have time for this. Stop calling me. I want to hang up. But you just keep reading the script anyway because you're not really a person making a phone call. You're like a cog in a machine fulfilling a function. And I think it's an episode that's aged really, really well in that regard, because I think that like as jobs have become more automated and as sort of societies become more mechanical, like I think a lot more people these days will empathize with that feeling of being a zombie or a drone in an office for 8 hours a day.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I love this episode, and I also totally love the idea that it's set in a telemarketing business. I think it's perfect setting for a paranormal monster. And the monster is actually reducing people working in telesales to zombies, like you said, which is both creepy but also kind of hilarious as well. I mean, just those jobs themselves are so monotonous and so soul-destroying that you could be feel like you're being reduced to a zombie anyway. And the idea that this monster would exploit, this would be the perfect environment for him to live and exploit, is just, I think, a genius piece of writing. I think the episode is really good at using the fear of the fear of not being believed. I also like the idea that that they've done some continuity in this episode. So Mulder is really irritated and annoyed at the beginning of the episode, and he actually at one point puts his hand up to his forehead in like a sort of gesture of exasperation. And that comes after the Pine Bluff variant, which was the episode before, which Mulder is basically tortured and kidnapped and tortured in, and that's one reason why his hand is injured. And you see in this episode his hand is injured. It also explains his attitude. Like, he's sick of it, you know, he's pissed off because he feels like he hasn't got anywhere after the last episode, and I think it's maybe slightly traumatized.
I'd go even further. I'd say, like, this is a rare... One of the things about the fifth season, I really like the fifth season as a bunch of TV episodes. I think there are some really great episodes in the fifth season as a whole. But I think one of my issues with the fifth season is that the arc doesn't really work. But, like, there's this sense at the start of the year that Mulder has become like disillusioned and bitter, that he started to doubt that the X-Files really contain anything of truth. There's this sense that like Mulder is more skeptical and he's more bitter and he's more disillusioned than he was before, and more kind of willing to question than he had been. The only problem is, of course, that all the standalone episodes of the fifth season depend on Mulder being exactly the same Mulder that he was during the fourth season. So it's like, yeah, kids who can control trees with their minds, I'm on board with that. Killer artificial intelligence, yep, I can go with that. Vampires, yep, I could go with that too. It feels strange that you have to get to the end of the season to get an episode that's kind of like a standalone monster of the week, that's kind of like, yeah, maybe Mulder is a bit sort of cynical, because he's like, you know, I'm the monster guy. That's what you do. You call me up and you send me in whenever anybody thinks they see a monster. I'm a joke, basically. My life is a joke. Everything that I've done is completely meaningless. Which feels like something that fits with the sort of larger mythology of the fifth season as a whole. Going back to like Carter's decision to suggest that the entire mythology was a lie and that Mulder is starting to doubt it. It's strange that it took a whole season to get a Monster of the Week episode where Mulder's like, actually, you know what? Maybe this Monster of the Week doesn't exist because I'm cynical now. And I kind of like that it's a rare episode that does that. And it fits with the theme perfectly as well. And there's a sense when Mulder says, look, I'm the monster guy. There's a sense that he's almost like the workers working this cubicle farm. He's reading off a script that has been assigned to him. He's dialing and smiling, so to speak, for the FBI.
It's an episode about doubting what you see and what you know. In a way, I guess that kind of ties into being a worker drone. Do you know, do you just follow what everyone's telling you, or do you trust your own instincts? You know, do you fight for yourself as an individual, or do you just go along with the crowd? And it's very much like you said, about that sort of theme. The hostage scenes are actually pretty tense and horrible, which makes the viewer question Gary's sanity. You know, I mean, you know there's got to be a monster in it, right? Because it's the X-Files. But yeah. It gets to the point during the hostage situation where you actually think Gary might actually be crazy, and there might be no monster until Mulder actually sees the monster. And that's a brilliant moment in the episode when he turns around and, you know, there's a close-up of Duchovny's face, and he's sort of looking over his shoulder with these eyes like wide with kind of disbelief and horror. And then when he turns back and looks at Gary, and there's just this moment of recognition between the two of them, and they're like, holy crap, you are telling the truth. You know, this guy really is a monster. And I think Kim Manis does a great job of directing, making Mulder appear tired, making him appear mentally stretched, just enough so that he can be doubted, and that Mr. Pincus is creepily normal.
He is. He's so boring, and he's so nice. As well, like I love the bit where he's like, well, look, I still think of Mulder as a hero. I don't want to make a big deal of this. We're willing to drop the case, even as I'm quietly trying to drive him mad.
And there's a good moment here where Mulder asks, is Gary able to see the monster because he's mentally disturbed? Yeah. Or was he mentally disturbed by seeing the monster? Which is kind of like a metaphor for Mulder and the X-Files, really. You know, is Mulder able to understand the paranormal because of this horrible experience he had as a child? And he's like, is Mulder crazy? And that's why he understands the paranormal, can investigate the X-Files? Or is it the X-Files and the paranormal that's kind of made him a little bit crazy? You know, like it's like this, you know, the chicken and the egg situation. I do think the monster is brilliant. I think he's one of the best monsters in the X-Files. He's like a man-sized insect, and he flickers and clicks and sort of shudders and twitches. And he appears so rarely that it looks so unreal that even the audience could question what they're seeing.
There's that really great sort of story about how when the monster first appeared, when they were filming the episode, when the monster had been designed as a costume, everybody thought it looked absolutely ridiculous. And when they filmed it, it didn't look great either. So what they did was they added this really great juddering effect. It moves like between frames. So there's this weird dissonance as you're watching it. It's like it's a stop motion creature that's sort of bouncing more than you can see in the space. It's almost like it's moving between your blinks. And I mean, there's a really great moment when Mulder's in the hospital bed and he's tied down. And he's looking out the window and he can see the twigs of the trees. And then all of a sudden, two of those twigs become the monster's antennae. Like, that's one of the best monster reveals in the entire history of the X-Files, I would argue.
Yeah, it's also very much like a parody of a little child in bed, in their bedroom, you know, frightened of a monster outside the window. It's a parody of that. Mulder is the child in bed, you know, that the parents don't believe. And the kid's like, but I saw it, you know. Another thing that was really interesting was Scully's faith in Mulder. And we often talk about Scully's faith throughout the series as something that's religious. You know, she has faith in God, she has faith in many things. This episode is very much about faith in Mulder. And I guess that's where Folie à Deux comes from. It's a madness. It's the only way she can describe it is a madness shared by the two of them. She looks at the body, the dead body that, that's been attacked by the monster. And that's just, the science helps her to open her mind. But really, it's her faith that actually saves Mulder in the end, because she's got, at that point, she's got no sort of rationalization or scientific proof when she goes to the hospital and sees the nurse as visualizes the nurse as a zombie. She's got no real scientific proof at that point of what exactly happened. She knows that the dead body's been dead for a while and there's some marks on the back of its neck.
But that's hardly substantial, I think, as she makes the case to Skinner as well. Like, even at the end, she explains she has nothing to go on to Skinner, but she still went on it because of Mulder, which I think is a great touch.
Yeah, yeah. So it's actually her faith in Mulder that allows her to see this threat in the end and allows her to see the monster rather than any sort of understanding of science. And I think that's hugely important because that does echo in the next episode, The End, as well.
Well, I think it echoes across the fifth season as a whole. Like, the fifth season leading into the movie does a lot of hard work to establish, like, the relationship between Mulder and Scully as something that is at this stage well beyond a platonic friendship. And I think the fifth season, I think that, like, Folie à Deux, its core dynamic with Mulder and Scully is basically that sort of thing. It's like, Mulder has seen this crazy monster thing, but will Scully believe him even if she doesn't believe in it? And I think it works really well in that sense. The movie and the fifth season leading into the movie are very invested in the relationship between Mulder and Scully, regardless of whether you think that's romantic or platonic or what. I think Folie à Deux does that excellently. I think it sort of captures that sense of Scully doesn't believe in the paranormal, but as you said, Scully believes in Mulder, and that's enough at this point. And I think that that's something very beautiful about this episode.
Yeah, I actually like the description of Folie à Deux at the end. I think it's the most fitting description of their relationship. I think it's one of the more romantic moments of the entire series, actually. This idea that, you know, you're crazy. You know you're crazy, but there's two of you in it together, and you're kind of crazy because you believe in each other. I think that's actually a lot more romantic than some of the stuff that comes later. So I like that idea. And like you said, that can be a platonic thing as well. So I don't think necessarily that this is romantic right away. Obviously, we'll go on to talk about the end. And in the end, there is some suggestion of romantic jealousy. The End is season 5, episode 20. It was written by Chris Carter and directed by R.W. Goodwin. First broadcast right after Folie à Deux.
May 17th.
May 17th, 1998. A rough sort of synopsis of what The End is that there is a little chess game going on between a chess master and a small chess prodigy, a boy named Gibson Praise. The assassination of the chess grandmaster happens during this competition, and it leads Mulder and Scully to investigate the assassination, and the mystery that they're investigating strikes into the heart of the X-Files, and they learn that the actual real target of the assassination was Gibson Praise. This is worth mentioning, this first teaser scene in which the grandmaster is actually shot, because the cool fact about this, which is that the stadium right at the beginning of the episode contains 17,000 extras, most of which I assume were X-Files fans in this stadium. And this is kind of at the end of the X-Files being filmed in Vancouver. So it's almost like a goodbye to Vancouver and letting the audience know that they're moving to LA. Darren, what did you think of this episode?
I quite like the love letter aspect of it being in Vancouver, to the point where, like, the scene after the episode mostly unfolds in Vancouver, which is kind of weird for, like, the American Federal Bureau of Investigation to be handling this case. But it's a nice little love letter, and then it goes to Quebec as well. Like, it's an episode that's very conscious of that move from sort of Vancouver southward to Los Angeles. But on the other hand, it's not an episode I'm immensely fond of. I think that it's not as good as, like, the Fight the Future, which it's leading into. And I don't even think it's as good as I quite like the beginning at the start of the sixth season. And I don't think it's as good as that. I think there are a lot of issues that I have with the end. But the biggest one is the kind of the weight that it puts on the character of Gibson Praise, which is the story arc has basically, well, first of all, Gibson Praise is not a very nice person. And it comes up repeatedly over the course of the episode. Gibson Praise is like this really awful, insufferable child. I don't mean that in a bad way. Like, I mean, Jeff Gulka's very good in the role. It's more the way he's written. Like, so for example, he's introduced, like, he manipulates the game. First of all, he's a chess grandmaster, but he's a chess grandmaster who cheats by reading the minds of his opponents, which is a really douchey thing to do. Like, if I were Mulder and I discovered this kid who was doing this, I'm not sure I would trust him, like, to be the embodiment of the X-Files. I'd be like, yeah, he used to use his mind-reading powers basically to hustle at chess, but I'm sure everything else is above board. But not only that, like, at the start of the episode, he manipulates the chessboard to ensure that, like, the chess grandmaster, who seems to be a completely innocent person, who likes playing chess, who doesn't cheat while playing chess, to be absolutely clear on this, gets shot through the head by a government assassin instead of Gibson. Now, Gibson could have done any number of things. He could have A, told his parents there was an assassin there, B, called the match, C, sort of left the table and went somewhere where there was shelter and protection, D, contacted the FBI. You could have done any number of things that wouldn't have ended in the death of an innocent grandmaster. But because he's this weird psychic kid with this sort of very warped sense of morality who thinks it's cool to do stuff like drop in, oh, by the way, Mulder is thinking about one of the two women in this room. And one of the two women is thinking about Mulder. But I'm not going to tell you which, because I'm sort of a manipulative tease, and I quite like having this weird psychic power over you. Like, Gibson Praise is a really creepy kid. And not only that, like, there's a sense in the episode that comes up repeatedly that Gibson Praise is the proof of everything that that is in the X-Files. Mulder makes a big deal of, like, going to the Attorney General with, like, Gibson as proof of, like, the X-Files and, like, validation of his belief. But the big problem with the episode is that it's never really explained why Gibson Praise is such a big deal in those terms. Like, why Mulder would go to the Attorney General with this case of this kid who can read minds, as opposed to going with, say, Robert Modell, who can control people with his voice, or Toombs, who can fit himself through any sort of gap. Like, it feels like a leap to get to a point in the episode where Mulder is embarrassed for the Attorney General and they can shut down the X-Files because they need to do that going into the movie. It doesn't feel earned. It doesn't feel like an organic development for me. It doesn't feel like a tightly plotted story. It feels like a bunch of ideas that the writers had on a board and just sort of threw them together and said, well, look, the movie's being released in a couple of weeks. We should probably get this out there.
I agree with you. Gibson Praise, you sort of feel that if he could read minds, like, geez, why doesn't he just read minds? It's like he's teasing everybody. He's being deliberately cryptic. And he seems too young to be that manipulative, which makes you think he's like a young, I don't know, psychopath or something. Like, and also, if he can read minds, like, why not put him in front of, like, the cigarette smoking man or something? Like, why not put him in front of someone that's actually going to give you some information? Yeah. You know, Gibson Praise himself can't give you the information because he's not involved in the conspiracy. He's like the tool, you know? So use the tool. And they never actually use him much later on in the series. He's such a poorly used character. The idea of psychics being used to expose secrets, I think, is something that's not a particularly original idea. And I can think of a number of situations in science fiction movies and television series where psychics are used to completely and utterly expose a mystery or a lie or a hidden conspiracy that are done a lot better than this. I mean, I like the idea of a psychic finding difficult to interact with other people because of all the noise, you know, of hearing other people's thoughts. So I like the idea of Gibson Praise enjoying cartoons, but there's way too many scenes of him enjoying cartoons in this episode. The end introduces too many main characters. I think that's one of the things I have a problem with. I'm not sure what Krycek is in it. I mean, Krycek was previously against the Syndicate. They've created too much of a role for him to now be relegated to some sort of, like, errand boy. That feels strange. But I did really enjoy Skinner's role in this episode. Mulder and Skinner have a lovely little chat. Skinner actually cares about Mulder, and it comes through. And he's curious about the X-Files, and he's trying to understand Mulder's motivations. And I like the idea of Skinner going down there to the basement office and not finding Mulder and just thinking, God, what is this guy up to? Or like, I wonder why he likes this stuff. You know, I like it when Skinner...
Well, Skinner is good dad, basically, is what...
Yeah, he's a good dad, yeah. So I like that sort of thing. But you're right, it's called The End, which means that I thought the episode was going to be this big, dramatic episode. And aside from the ending, where the X-Files is actually
burnt
on fire and a whole office is sort of reduced to ashes, the episode is actually made up of small, intimate and emotional scenes between characters. There's very little big drama in it. It's big development. It's mainly little scenes between people coming and going and speaking to each other, and kind of this angst between Diana Fowley and Mulder and Scully, which feels fairly contrived to me, although Diana Fowley is a much better character than Phoebe, Mulder's ex-girlfriend from the first series. But there's some great parallels between Spender and Mulder, and Spender and, like, cigarette-smoking man. Like, I can believe they're all related to each other, you know? They all sort of seem as equally driven and cryptic and kind of intense as each other. Just Spender and Mulder, like, arguing with each other. I could see that they could be
half brothers. By the way, Mulder is a complete jerk to Spender. Like, I am entirely on Team Spender. Now, obviously, that changes as we go into the sixth season. But at the start of The End, I am totally on Team Spender, where Spender's like, hey, I'm going to give a presentation to a whole room full of special agents. I'm very inexperienced. I've just got out of the academy. I'm very shy. I'm a little nervous. I'm sort of projecting this image of myself to other people so they'll trust that I'm a competent individual. And then this guy who lives in the basement shows up, and not only does he humiliate me, he makes a point of humiliating me slowly and surely in front of a room full of people by having me go back, rewind the tape, drawing the attention of everybody in the room to the mistake that I made that, you know, to be honest, is probably a little over, you know, understandable given that I don't believe in psychics. I can understand why Spender would be a little bit miffed at Mulder. And I can understand, like, I can't understand why Scully or Skinner didn't, like, take Mulder aside and say, look, Mulder, don't be this, don't be that guy.
Yeah, I mean, I actually quite like the character of Spender. And even later on when he's revealed to be doing things that are, you know, against the, you know, it's to thwart our heroes later on in the season and the series, I actually still really like him. I actually think Spender's a bit of a victim, to be honest. I think he lucked out. He didn't luck out by having probably one of the worst fathers known to anybody, into history. You know, the worst father in history. And he doesn't have a Scully to help him and support him. What do you think of the character of Diana Fowley?
I feel like Fowley was a character who was never as well used as she should have been, to be honest. Like, I think Mimi Rogers is very good in the role, but I feel like the character is never properly realised or developed. Fowley exists, and we talked about this when we talked about Folie à Deux, where the fifth season puts an emphasis on the relationship between Mulder and Scully. Fowley is very clearly intended as a third wheel, basically, to Mulder. To Scully. Like, she's meant to be like this romantic foil, or this personal foil, this intimacy foil. Maybe not romantic. Maybe romantic's the wrong word. But like, she's meant to be this character who comes in and potentially usurps Scully's position as Mulder's advisor or confidant or somebody he trusts. I think there are some very interesting ideas that are suggested with Fowley later on, particularly when you discover where her true intentions lie and what she's sort of allowed herself to become complicit with and what she's come to believe, that aren't really explored. But in terms of the end, I feel like she's underdeveloped. And like, you mentioned this earlier, like, one of the issues with the end, it's like, it's the issue where you have Krycek becoming the well-manicured man's driver. It's where the episode is overstuffed with all these characters, when what the end should be doing is it should be leading into the big movie that's coming out in the middle of summer. But it's got all these characters who appear in the end, but don't appear in the movie. So, for example, Krycek plays a big role in the end, but doesn't appear in the feature film. Gibson Praise is the focus of the end, but doesn't appear in the feature film. Diana Fowley and Jeffrey Spender are both major players in the end, but they don't appear in Fight the Future. Like, there's this really weird dissonance when you're watching it, particularly when you're watching it in order, where it feels like going from the end to going to the feature film, the only thing that really carries over is like the burning of the X-Files at the end. If you cut everything out of the end except the final 4 minutes, like, you would actually have a much smoother sort of segue into the feature film. And that, I think, sort of jars me when I'm watching it. I feel like these characters don't really have a purpose in what they're doing, except for the fact that maybe the writers think they should be here because it's a season finale, because you have to have these characters involved somehow, even if we don't know what we're doing with them. And that's sort of like, that's my big issue with the end. You talked about it being like a series of smaller, intimate moments and conversations. I feel like those moments of conversations don't go anywhere, or go where they really should be going, or go anywhere where they need to go. And I think, like, the beginning is a much better job of kind of segueing out of the movie than the end does sort of segueing in, if that makes sense.
I agree with you. I think this doesn't really add much to the movie at all. I think you could just watch the movie on a standalone without having watched the end, and it wouldn't make any difference.
Yeah.
All right, so the next episode, which will be tomorrow, is episode 60, which will be the Fight the Future movie episode, analysing that. So please do tune in for tomorrow. You can find us on Twitter at @X_cast and the Facebook page, where you can join and talk to other X-Files fans about the show. So until next time, trust no one.